Today, rescue teams say they're not giving up hope for three climbers missing in wintry conditions on Mount Hood in Oregon. It's been a week since they set out for a planned two-day trip. On Sunday, Kelly James, one of the missing climbers, reached his son by cell phone and told him the climbing party was in trouble. No one has talked with him since. His wife, Karen James, spoke today at a press conference and thanked rescue crews.
And we just can't say enough of these men and women that keep going out there day after day to bring these people home to us. And just a very special thanks to all of America for praying with us.
Late Tuesday, a signal was received from a climber's cell phone, and the Hood River County Sheriff's Department expressed optimism that the climbers are still alive. But the weather's not cooperating. High winds, expected to reach over 100 miles per hour, and more than a foot of snow are blocking the rescue effort, and officials don't know when they'll be able to reach the stranded men. Fran Sharp is the president of the National Mountain Rescue Association, and she joins us by phone from her office in Washington State. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
We'd also like to hear from climbers and hikers. If you've been on a search and rescue team, or if you've climbed in bad weather and been rescued, join the conversation. Our number here is 800-989-8255, or send us an email to talk@npr.org. Fran Sharp, what is the most difficult thing about this search that's going on right now?
Well, definitely, Lynn, it seems like the weather is just hindering the efforts of the rescue teams to get even close to where they're at. From what I've heard, they can't really even see their feet very well because the visibility is so poor from the blowing snow. So that makes it very difficult to search, nearly impossible to see much more than just your own footsteps. It's also a dangerous time for them to be on the mountain. High avalanche conditions, of course, hypothermia is always a danger as well, even with experienced rescuers. So, Mother Nature's not helping us at all.
Yeah. You have been on Mount Hood, as I understand it.
I have, yes.
And is it particularly difficult to climb?
It's a very popular mountain to climb. It's close to a large city, Portland, and not too far from Seattle. So there's a lot of folks who can go to this mountain. There are routes that are relatively easy to do. You can do with just basic experience. Then there's routes that are much harder, like on the north side, where you need much more technical expertise.
Now, one of the climbers, Kelly James, managed to call his son, and he told him that he was in a snow cave near the summit. Is that a good place to be?
That is a good thing. Experienced mountaineers know that they have to get shelter and get out of those conditions. The wind chill, the blowing snow, they need to get some shelter. And on a mountain where there's no trees, of course, and no, housing or other shelter, you actually dig a snow cave, which is basically a hole in the snow that you stay in, and it really offers very good protection.
And can you stay warm there? You're in a snow cave, so, you still can get hypothermia, I assume.
You can, because it's, still in the 30s or, it can be a little bit colder, but it gives much more protection than being exposed or even being in a tent. It's on a lot of, high-altitude expeditions, they will spend many, many days and sometimes even weeks in a snow cave, and it offers very good protection from the elements.
We are talking about search and rescue missions. If you've ever been involved in one, either as the rescuer or as the person who was saved, give us a call. The number is 800-989-8255. Now, what are some of the things that rescue teams do to coordinate what's going on during a search?
Well, there's always, it's called an incident commander. And they are typically like the sheriff's department in this case. And they organize the search in all the different rescue teams. It's not just, folks from rescue teams just showing up and heading off. It's a very organized search. There's a lot of search theory that goes on. Many people take classes and become experts in search, where you look at terrain, how old the people are, what their skill level is, what the weather's doing, possible routes down, and you try to find, they call them an area with a high POS or POD, which is probability of success or probability of detection, and you try to get your teams to those areas first. And so all the teams will be reporting to basically one commander, and they'll be assigned different assignments through the whole the whole search area, depending on where they think those climbers are.
Now, something that's happening in this particular rescue mission and that is new to this whole kind of endeavor is the use of cell phones. I mean, the signal from this cell phone was tracked by the cell phone company. How does that work? How does that help the rescue efforts?
Well, it's definitely becoming more of a help for us. It depends on from what I understand, the authorizing agencies like the Sheriff's Department have to actually contact the phone companies and get that started. No one can just call the cell phone company and try to track a cell phone. That can lead to a lot of other problems. But it does. You can triangulate from different towers where the cell phone is actually the transmission's going through those towers, and then they can triangulate and pinpoint fairly close to where the signal is coming from. So, yeah, cell phones, gosh, people would not have known they were missing for a while without that original cell phone call on Sunday, so it can definitely initiate searches much earlier than not having one.
Fran Sharp is the president of the National Mountain Rescue Association. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. We're going to take a call now from Melody, and she is in Syracuse, New York. Hi, Melody.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I was in the Grand Canyon in July and had sort of the opposite conditions, a heat wave, very humid, and while they offered to rescue me, they also made it clear that I would need to reimburse them. So I wonder, in the end, when people do these dangerous things, are especially these expeditions that are planned, are they expected to pay for all the rescue costs?
Well, actually, the Mountain Rescue Association has a very strong stance on charging for rescues. And In some of the national parks now, they are starting to have some rescue cost recovery fees. We don't like to see that.
Okay.
What happened to you, Melody? What was your situation?
I was with an Austrian who didn't realize that as you go down instead of up, it gets hotter and more humid, and it was record temperatures quite a few years ago. And I decided I was going to take a shortcut, and so I basically walked what I thought was one of the trails, but it became a wash and was looking down a 1,000-foot cliff. And, you know, it took me, I think, a couple days. I went down finally, and they gave me some water and a flashlight if I wanted to, and I decided to walk myself out. They would have flown me out, but it would have been something like $400.
So you had to walk yourself out ultimately?
Yes, ultimately I walked myself out, but it was after I got some of the, I don't know what you call it, the water with the vitamins in and so on.
All right.
Got rehydrated, and then I decided at 3 o'clock in the morning to try to walk out, and I did.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your call, Melody.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Steve. He's in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Steve. Steve, you there?
I am. I'm a climber. I summited it a few years ago, and this is obviously extremely concerning, and my heart goes out to the families. But the comment that I wanted to make is that there are certain windows of time that expeditions are safer or more dangerous. There are certain months that Hood is a safer mountain to climb, and December is probably the apex of when it's not safe to climb because of the potential for weather. So I recognize that as the climbing community, we look out for one another, and I recognize that we don't want to set up ridiculous barriers with costly fee recovery. But by the same token, it seems to me that when people choose to climb into dangerous times of the year and potentially climb into weather, there's a heightened degree of responsibility for the circumstance you put yourself in. And then in the end, the circumstance that you put rescue teams in. I'd like to take your comments.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for your call, Steve. That's an interesting point, Fran Sharp, that at times people really are taking risks when they get into these situations. And
well, definitely there are, and as Steve pointed out, there's safer times to climb, although things happen during those safe times as well. And I'm sure that the folks on the mountain are looking at the responsibility that they chose. And although they are responsible for it, any of the mountain rescue teams can always say, no, we don't feel that like we should be doing this. It is too dangerous for our rescuers. And those decisions are made on a regular basis. As far as the cost for recoveries, 95% of the rescues, particularly for outdoor wilderness in the United States, are done by volunteer search and rescue. So there is no, it's kind of a myth because we see on TV many helicopters and lots of people on the mountain. Large, large majority are volunteers, so there's no additional cost to the taxpayers. Many of the military helicopters and airplanes that are used are doing it as a training mission. So again, it's very good training for them because it's tougher conditions, more realistic than just, you know, doing a little flight around. So again, no extra cost there. So it's very it's kind of a myth that these are very expensive operations.
But the rescuers are putting themselves at risk, are they not, sometimes when they go on these missions? And mm-hmm. and are rescuers ever injured or lost themselves?
We do put ourselves at risk, and that absolutely is part of it. And that remains a personal decision for each person on the team, as well as the leaders of the team have to assess that constantly. But we train a lot. We're very experienced in this, so we try to minimize that risk, of course, and we carry a lot of gear. We're not going, you know, for a summit climb. We're going to rescue people. So we really take that into account. I'm trying to think of the most dangerous part of a rescue for the folks in our organization is driving to and from. That's where more accidents and more rescues
on the road
than actually during a rescue.
Fran Sharp is the president of the National Mountain Rescue Association, and you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take a call now from Bob, and he is calling from New York. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I owned a small airplane, and I was flying from Los Angeles to visit my sister for Christmas in Montana, and I took off in bad weather. It was my fault that I put the airplane down because it was a small airplane, underpowered and everything. But I ended up spending about 28 hours on the side of a 10,000-foot mountain in Wyoming.
Wow.
Hello?
Did you think you were going to get rescued, or
what happened was I lost all the radio in the airplane, radios, but all small airplanes are equipped with what's called an ELT, Emergency Locator Transmitter. And these are direct satellite hookup, which works on the military reconnaissance, and they can track as soon as this gets the radio is impacted, it sets off a signal which sends a signal to satellites. And what I wanted to comment was on that I think all climbers should be equipped with something in that kind of category as far as technology, and they work incredibly well. I mean, with an accuracy of 100 or 200 yards. I mean, and if you're really for searching for someone in a wilderness area, and I was about 14 miles off into the wilderness, and what I found was that not only did I have an ELT, it had a voice transmit, which most of them don't have, and this was what really saved my life, is once I saw airplanes circling in the area, I could actually plug a microphone into it and talk to the helicopter.
Wow, that's incredible. Fran Sharp, what do you think of what Bob is suggesting here, Fran?
Well, those are available. They're called PLBs, or personal locator beacons, and they do use them. I believe they have a resource you can use on Mount Hood for that. They're not perfect. In fact, I'm a fixed-wing pilot as well, and there is a high failure rate for ELTs. But PLBs are more reliable because you typically hit the switch and turn it on when you're in trouble. It's something that we're seeing a small amount of people use. The problem, I think, again, getting back to the myth of search and rescue, is that it's a very, very small amount of people we go after, our climbers. Primarily, I believe it's in the high 90s, our missions are for hikers, for people who just want a day walk in a park, you know, folks who drove off the road, those type of things. And so to really get bang for the buck, everyone would have to have a PLB. So, yes, it would definitely help for climbers in this situation. We still would not be able to get to them. We would just know, you know, where they were on the mountain. The weather would still prohibit getting to them, probably. It's just it can help, but it's not the cure-all, and certainly search and rescue in general. You'd have to have everyone who goes outside using a PLB.
All right, let's go to Jerry in Tallahassee, Florida. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I moved to Portland, Oregon 20 years ago, and it was right after there was a tragic accident on Mount Hood. A group of high school students on a school-sponsored event got trapped in a freak snowstorm and perished. And right after that, the people there at Mount Hood decided that if you wanted to climb Mount Hood, you had to have one of these transmitters with you. And I thought it was a requirement, and I'm just wondering what if it is a requirement there. You have to go up to Timberline Lodge and rent one before you go up the mountain.
Fran Sharp?
No, it's from what I understand, there's no requirement for it. It's just a resource that you can use, but there's no requirement on Mount Hood as far as I know.
What do you think people should take with them? What is needed on when they're going?
It really depends what they're going to do, Lynn. If they're doing a hike around the area, the Mountaineers, which are a Seattle group, and there's many other climbing groups that do this, have a list of the 10 essentials, and I think they do the 10 essentials plus 4, and it's extra food, flashlight, those type of things. It can be accessed on many websites to get that list. If you're doing climbs, that's really a whole other arena, depending on how technical the climb is. Basically, you always consider that you may be out for longer, you know, a day or two longer.
So take some extra warm clothes, something like that.
Absolutely.
All right. Yep. Thanks so much for being with us today, Fran.
Thank you.
Fran Sharp is the president of the National Mountain Rescue Association, and she joined us by phone from her office in Washington State. And finally today, we have to say goodbye to someone we care for very much. We're saying farewell to Setsuko Sato, who produced today's show. She's been with NPR for almost a decade, and we will miss her creativity, her knack for recognizing the next big thing, and her passion for telling a good story. She leaves us to get married and to return to her home city of New York. We wish her lots of luck and happiness. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington.